I know certainly a lot of people are. Our daughter's headed out on fall break, and I know a lot of other families are gone as well. It's good to see some of you shuffling around. I like that over here. One quick announcement as we're getting started. Coming up October the 14th, our youth group is taking a group up to go to the Haunted Woods. Over in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And if you have an interest in going and chaperoning or your team coming, please contact my wife so that she can make sure and let them know how many to prepare for and we can get tickets and all that. That's October 14th, the Haunted Woods. I know Jonathan would normally be making this announcement, but he is gone with his family on fall break. So we're just kind of filling in for Jonathan a little bit this morning. All right. Have you ever had a bad customer service experience? Just raise your hand if you have had a bad customer service experience. Oh, okay. I'm going to do just quick service. Somebody tell me one of the companies you had a bad service. I mean, don't say like Markham's Pharmacy or anything like that. But if like you could... Some big company. Let's stick with that so nobody gets their feelings hurt. All right, some company you had a bad customer service experience with. Comcast, AT&T, Verizon Wireless. What was that? I couldn't hear that. I'm a little deaf. All right, we got a bunch. You guys actually hit some of the top ones. This last year, there were several companies that made the bad list of customer service. And number one on many lists was Comcast. Number two on most lists, Time Warner Cable. Number three, AT&T. And I've got an AT&T story of my own. Sometime I'll share with you if you're just really bored. You know those three have to be bad if number four was Wells Fargo. That's what my thinking is. Number five was Dish Network. And don't you just hate it when you get caught up in those things? They get you so mad. They get you so frustrated because you're fighting with a system that doesn't seem to pay attention to what you're trying to get accomplished. They don't seem to care anything at all about you or your situation whatsoever. So every once in a while, somebody will get so caught up in this and so upset at what has happened to them that they feel compelled to sort of strike back at the company that has wronged them. And I there are some fantastic stories out there of that. I just wanted to share one with you this morning. The Bank of America, who has often been on these bad customer service lists, they foreclosed on a home, the home of Warren and Maureen Nergis. I believe that's the way you pronounce their last name. Anyway, it was in Naples, Florida. This surprised Warren and Maureen because they didn't have a mortgage. Not with Bank of America or anybody else. They bought their house outright, paid cash for it. Well, Mr. Nergis tried to make phone calls to the bank, try to clear things up. He went down to the bank. He spoke to whoever would listen to him. He even wrote a certified letter to the bank president. No response, nothing. So he hired an attorney, and 2 months later, the foreclosure was dismissed. 2 months of his home being in foreclosure, he finally got it dismissed. But now, the Bank of America owed the Nergis for their legal fees, right? That's the way it's supposed to work. And the court agreed, yes, just you ought to pay them back for the legal fees. So 5 months passed, more phone calls, more letters, more ignoring, no payment. So eventually, the Nergis went back to court, and they got a writ of execution, which gave them permission to seize the bank assets in payment for his judgment. And on June 3rd, the Nergis, two sheriff's deputies, and a moving truck showed up at the local Bank of America branch, and they foreclosed on it. Don't you just love that? They got to foreclose on the bank. I mean, that's fantastic. Man, can't you just imagine the satisfaction of walking up to that bank with the sheriff's deputy and the moving vans behind them? I mean, how great would that have felt? I mean, I would have hired like a wind machine and a spotlight as I walked in. Maybe not. I mean, what else could he do? I mean, there was nothing else he could do. What would you do in that situation? Here were these people who'd worked and worked and worked on the problem, and they'd waited and they'd waited and they'd waited. What were they going to get for their troubles? You know, nothing. They were going to get worse than nothing. They were going to get bills. And so if it were me, I might have just told everyone to leave and padlocked the doors and treat them the way they treated me. That's what I'd have been tempted to do. And then when they tried to get in touch with me, I'd have treated them the same way that when I tried to get in touch with them. That would have been satisfying too. Well, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 5, we get a very similar kind of story, almost like an ancient customer service kind of story. And it's the parable of the vineyard. I'm not going to read the whole parable here, but here's the gist of it. This man, he bought a fertile piece of land on a hillside. And it was the perfect setting for a vineyard. So he plowed it up just so, just perfectly. And when you do that, especially when you're plowing in that part of the country, you come across a lot of rocks. It's a pretty rocky kind of soil. But rather than just getting frustrated with the rocks, what they do is they make use of them. So he takes the rocks that he plows up, and he uses them to build a wall around the perimeter of the property. That's to keep kind of marauding animals from out from coming in and ravaging the vineyard and eating all of his produce, and it protects the vineyard. So he takes the rocks, he builds this protective property, or protective wall around the property, and then later he uses the rest of the stones, which did not happen in many cases, but to build a watchtower. Now this would only happen if this was a particularly valuable piece of property. I mean, you wouldn't spend all that time and money building a watchtower to protect a piece of property that wasn't valuable, right? I mean, that don't make sense. You've got to have somebody there to watch it. And so what usually would happen is if an owner was really interested in this, it was like his choice vineyard, he might build a watchtower and then actually move onto the property and live there in the midst of the vineyard so that he could watch over it. So he builds this watchtower, indicating not only that he's got great wealth, but again, a great deal of interest in this property, probably going to live here permanently. He also builds a vat for processing his produce. He has got this whole thing. This is all labor intensive. There's no backhoes. There's no ditch witches. There's nothing to get this all accomplished. This is all sweat and back-breaking work. But he does this. And for 2 years, he cares for this piece of land and expecting it to eventually yield some really high-quality grapes. He's done everything this land needs to produce a high-quality crop. And that's a great deal of patience on his part that he's exhibited. He's planted the best vines, but what he has received, the text says, is bad fruit. Now literally, the Hebrew for this means stinky things. That's literally what the bad fruit is there. In fact, they're called, he says, these vines are behaving like wild vines. Now, the only difference between wild grapes or wild grapevines and domestic grapevines is the care that they receive. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that all the grapes were wild at one point, right? But it takes a lot of care and cultivation and keeping the weeds out and making sure. That's how eventually we get domesticated grapes, is a lot of care and attention. And that's precisely what he's done, which is really frustrating, because here he's put all this time and attention and effort and work and sweat into these grapes, and what he's getting instead of the fine, cultured, cultivated grapes, the sweet flavor that they're so cherished for, what he's getting instead is these bitter, stinky, wild grapes. So this man is really frustrated at this point. He sort of just throws his hands up, and he's so upset by this that he's not just going to abandon his vineyard and walk away. No, he's going to assist in its destruction. He's kind of like the jilted customer in our modern customer service stories. He says, I'm not just going to cut down the protective hedge, which he apparently has planted around it, with another way to keep people and animals out. He planted a thorny hedge around the perimeter of the property to keep it safe. He said, I'm going to cut down the hedge that I planted. I'm going to destroy the wall that I built, And I'm going to make sure that it doesn't even get any water. And then animals are going to come all over this thing, and it's just going to be all torn up, and it's going to become another worthless piece of property. And that resonates with me. I haven't done a lot of gardening in my time. I've done a little bit, a very little bit, and I'm not great at it, but I understand that when you put time and effort and work into a piece of land, you expect to get something from it. And I get that way, not just in farming, but in life. Like, I get wanting to bring down this entity who has cost you so much money, cost you so much time, cost you so much work and effort. And it's kind of, again, it's kind of like our customer service stories where we say, not only am I leaving your business, I'm taking my business and going elsewhere, but I'm taking you down, right? Like, we want to lash out in frustration. Which makes the next part of this story particularly hard to swallow. Because in this story, you and me, we're not the man. In this story, God is the man. And you and me are the vineyard. We're the frustrating part of this story. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 7. He says, "The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel." Now, I'm not saying that you and I are the nation of Israel. We are called the new Israel. We are a part of God's people now. I'm not trying to say everything is exactly the same. But bear in mind, this is about God's frustration with his own people. And this, in this case, it's Israel. And in our case, would be the church. It's the nation of Israel. And the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice. Now, I'm going to give you a few Hebrew words here, not because it's important that you know them, but I want you to see the play on words that God does here. He looked for justice, mishpat is the Hebrew word, but instead he saw bloodshed, mishpach. Looked for mishpat, got mishpach. He looked for righteousness, tzedakah, but he heard the cries of distress, tzaakah. God's looking for one thing and he finds something else, right? After all God has done for his people, all of his love, all of his devotion, all of his care and providence, right? He's given them everything they need for success, and all he gets is this bad fruit of bloodshed and distress. And when you go on, you keep reading down through the rest of Isaiah 5, you see that there's other bad fruit. There's bad fruit like injustice and arrogance, bad fruit like perversion and self-indulgence. I mean, it is just bad fruit after bad fruit after bad fruit. The problem that Isaiah is addressing here, the one that emerges, especially when we do some historical studies, is that about this time in Israel, there was the emergence of a wealthy class. Like, as they began, there's always been people who had more, people who had less. But it was about this time in Israel's history that you really get a class-based system, and you get the rich. And these wealthy people have turned more and more of their attention to pleasure and indulgence. And they're the ones who run the country because they have the money. Sound familiar to anyone, by the way? This ought to resonate with us who live in a country of wealth and indulgence. This is what God says in verse 8. "Woe to you who add house to house." And what that means is make your house bigger and bigger, kind of in taking in the land around you. "Who join field to field." You snatch up the property of the poor people and make the rich people property bigger and bigger. "Till no space is left and you live alone in the land." That's how you take over. You don't have to buy all the land, just all the land that's touching yours. You take in their house, you take in their land, and pretty soon you've got an estate. You've got a plantation. These are the people, he says, goes on to say, they get up early and go to bed late so that they can drink, so that they can party, and so that they can listen to music. Now, that's literally what's going on here. They're like entirely given to their entertainment and their providence and getting what they want out of this whole situation. They're so busy taking care of their stuff that they have no time to contemplate God, no time to slow down as Rob pointed out, and we're kind of busy people. They're so busy taking care of their time, their stuff, that they have no time to slow down and stop and think about God. I mean, they don't have time to slow down and think about anything, certainly not God. They work full time at their own interests, interests that have like nothing to do with God or His kingdom or what He's done for them or is doing for them. When the passions for your pleasure become the most important thing in your life, what we'll realize is that the passion for God and His truth is always squeezed out. When the passion for your pleasure becomes the most important thing in your life, the most important thing in your life is getting what you want, then the passion for God and His Word is just squeezed right out. Just not room for it anymore. That's what God's addressing here in Israel, and I would argue this is a prophetic word for you and me too. It's after all God has done for His people, whether it's ancient Israel or present day Christians, this is what He gets. This is the fruit of His people. So what's He going to do? He's going to tear down those walls that they complain about, because those walls, they limit our view. He's going to tear down the hedges that we kind of see as keeping us hemmed in. He's going to tear down the barriers that have been up there for our protection all along. We complain about what God actually does because it keeps us from doing what we want to do. And so withdrawal of God's hand of protection is the inevitable result of sin. Sin is not always about doing something horrible, you see. Sin is ultimately about doing your way instead of God's way. Once you kind of get it in your head that you know how to better take care of yourself, and that maybe your culture or your people or your nation or whoever it may be is more right than God, then ultimately you want your way and not God's. And God says, finally, all right, you want it your way? I'll tear down that protection. You can just go have right at it. See how you fare. And that's the exact opposite of what God wants. The exact opposite. God has always chosen His people, just as He's chosen Israel and chosen you and I and Christians the world over. He has chosen us, elected us is a kind of the scripture way of referring to that, in order to produce righteousness. We are not elected. You did not become a Christian because you were good. Oh, let's not kid anybody. We did not become Christians. We were not chosen to be the children of God because we were particularly good, particularly righteous, because our hearts were so pure, because we always did the right thing, because we knew the right doctrines or knew the right amount of scripture or said the right prayers. We were not chosen to be people of God because we were good. We were chosen by God to become His children so that He might make us good. He's trying to produce righteousness in us. And so as we live in a culture that is consumed with its own entertainment, and make no mistake about it, we live in the most self-satisfying culture in the history of the world. We are sort of consumed with being a consumer, right? It's not enough. We've talked about this before, but it's not enough that we have a really functional cell phone. What I need is the latest functional cell phone. It's not enough that we have a working car. I need the nicest and the newest and the best working car. It's not enough that I have clothes that fit me and are clean and don't have holes in them. That's not enough. I need this year's clothes that fit me and are clean and don't have holes in them. We're not just a materialistic culture. We're a consumer-driven culture because we got to get whatever's new. And so God says into this mindset, if that's what you want to do, that's fine, but I'm going to remove my hand of protection from you. Or you could live into the election to which I've called you. You could live as elected people and let me produce righteousness in you. Now, we've all had those frustrating stories, as we talked about at the beginning, of maybe not being treated right by the big businesses or the corporations or whomever it may be. But when we stop to consider how we have treated the God who has cared for and provided to us, it's a little more sobering. It's a little more intimate. It's a little more humbling, isn't it? To think, I've been the jerk. I've been the one who's taken advantage of a God who has been so patient. If this morning you need encouragement, if you need prayers, if you need strength, we want you to know that we as a church family, that's the direction we want to walk. We want to pursue righteousness. We don't have to be like those around us. We don't have to be like the culture around us. We can be like the people God has called us to be. If we can help you with that in any way this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing? My